Hi, and welcome to the Georgia Politics Podcast Show. This is Joseph G. I run Doraville.org, and I have a personal site at monotonous.net. We're here to talk about Georgia politics, and the date is April 9th, 2006. I'm going to start off and go to the person at my left, and we're just going to kind of introduce ourselves first before we get started. I'll start with you, Garrett.
Thanks. My name is Garrett Vonk, and this is sort of my first political participation of any kind beyond voting and your typical blog commenting and so forth. So I'm really excited to be participating. I've lived in Georgia exactly half my life, bona fide, little L libertarian, haven't been registered in any official context for several years. I keep a personal blog at garrettvonk.com, and I'm hoping to contribute today.
This is a Decatur guy. I run a blog at atlantapublicaffairs.blogspot.com. I also have front page privileges at peachpundit.com, which I try to rile people up over there. So I'm looking forward to talking about Georgia politics today, and I hope we have a good show.
My name is Catherine Smith, and I am the co-proprietress as well as regular poster at blogfordemocracy.org. I've lived in Georgia for 10 years, and I'm looking forward to the conversation as well.
All right, and my name is Joe Winter, and I have a personal blog at joeventures.com, and also I run a site called bloglanta.com for fans of everything ITP. And I guess that's about it. So back to Joseph.
Okay, well, great. I'm glad you guys could all be here. Thank you for accepting my invitation. I'm really excited about this. Even though I know everyone's kind of like, well, nothing really happened in the Georgia state legislature this session. They did do a few things, even though maybe it wasn't quite as bad as it could have been. Probably one of them was the Ten Commandment Bill, which I think started as HB 941. My legislature, Jill Chambers, voted for this, even though she's got a reputation as being like the liberal Republican in the state legislature. And I think only one Republican legislator actually did vote against it, and that was Fran Miller. Does anyone have any thoughts on this? I think that it's right now waiting to be signed into law by Sonny Perdue, but I don't see him not signing it.
No, well, if you want to give a little background, I mean, this bill would allow courthouses and judiciaries to display these. I think they've got like 10 documents on there, and the whole idea is that it's in sort of a historical context. So they've got some important stuff on here: the Mayflower Compact, Declaration of Independence, the Magna Carta, the Star-Spangled Banner, the national motto, which I guess is In God We Trust, the preamble to the Constitution, the Bill of Rights, I guess including the First Amendment, and the description of the image of Lady Justice, which is justice being blind, and so on and so forth. And then the Ten Commandments, as extracted from Exodus chapter 20. That's actually in the language of the bill. So I think that these other historical documents, there's no need for them to even debate these other things. I think they threw these in here, you know, to sort of paint the whole picture that they're going for this historical perspective rather than there being the real...
Well, I think they know that the Supreme Court already said you can't just put the Ten Commandments in a courthouse right now.
Well, I just want to make sure, I want to clarify something. Is this something that they can choose to do or that they have to do?
They can choose to do it, and actually I think there's a... correct me if I'm wrong, I think there's a line in there about not taking any public money to do it.
I think the way that it works, actually, like a county courthouse or a city courthouse or something, if they decide they want to take this package of items from, you know, that the state has defined as okay to put up, then they aren't liable for any of the lawsuits that come from it. The state's going to end up picking up the bill. So basically, all the people in Atlanta are going to pay for, you know, like...
Barrow County's,
Ten Commandments fight.
That's exactly what this bill is, and it's outrageous that Barrow County can decide for the rest of Georgia to post these Ten Commandments or whatever and charge it to the rest of the state. If Barrow County wants to challenge the law that prohibits them from posting the Ten Commandments, they should have to pay for it, not people in DeKalb County.
And it will be fought. I mean, the ACLU will absolutely fight it, and they will win. And they have the best, their constitutional attorney in Atlanta won the Ten Commandment thing in Alabama. So we've got some experts in Georgia that will fight against us.
Just yet another attempt by conservative Republicans to pass these laws that they're going to have to pay to defend. I mean, it makes no sense.
And you know what? One of the ironies about this, with the whole Ten Commandments thing, is that we don't even all share the same set of Ten Commandments. If I was a member of the legislature, I'm surprised that no one's done this before. If I was a member of the legislature, I would carry a Torah scroll. That's the whole first five books of what I guess we would all call the Bible in its original Hebrew, and translate for them what's actually in there, which is different from the set of commandments that a lot of Christians use.
Well, Joe, and I'm not a Founding Fathers expert, but I think that there is a place for the historical context of if let's just say that 100% of these guys were Christian, even down to taking the language from the Bible and using it to craft our laws. I think there's a place for that. I think we've got all kinds of museums, we've got all kinds of repositories and books. But I think the problem with putting them in courthouses and judicial buildings is that these are places where our government governs. And we can't afford to favor a religious agenda in these places that are so important to our governance.
Absolutely.
It doesn't have any authenticity in a historical context, because there's plenty of places for us to celebrate our history, even if that history were 100% pure Christian.
Absolutely. And Ben Franklin, just to use as an example, had even stated that he believes in... What was it? He said it was like religion, but not in particular. He was just in favor of the whole idea that there could be religion, but not some kind of a sanctioned, we're all practicing the same thing type of ideology.
So shame on you, Jill Chambers.
You know, and I'm kind of disappointed that I don't have a conservative on this panel.
Well, I've got some quotes from the supporters of the bill.
Okay.
But it's not going to, I don't think in the eyes of, or in the ears of any of our listeners, I don't think it's going to redeem them, because it really actually helps to show that there's really a religious agenda behind it. This policy group, Ten Commandments Georgia, spoke with Zell Miller earlier this year, and they said, "It is our mission to help redeem the citizens of the state of Georgia. The Ten Commandments movement is ultimately about the gospel of Jesus Christ. Now is the time to drain the swamp of the alligators that are ruling our nation."
And this bill is going to do that.
If anyone has any question as to whether they have any ounce of historical reverence for these documents, rather than pushing a religious agenda.
I would start my appeal off with that.
Right.
Yes. Really quickly, I also kind of wanted to just bring up all the illegal immigration discussion that's been going on in Georgia for the past several months, and it's kind of weird because there's been illegal immigration my whole life, and I grew up in California, so maybe I saw it a little bit more than some of the people who grew up in the South. It doesn't seem like anything new that's really going on here. And I think that there's something to be said for, like, okay, well, they're breaking the law, it's illegal immigration, but I don't think that this is necessarily a state issue.
Well, what surprises me is that, you know, I think I did a post on this recently, or responded to somebody's blog recently. Most of the people of origin from China in this country, living in this country today, are illegal immigrants. Why do we never hear about Chinese illegal immigrants? Why is it always the Hispanics?
Of course not, because they're smart.
It's because for whatever reason, the Asian Americans have done a better job, according to some people, of fitting into American culture. This is not about illegal immigration. It's about people who do not like Hispanics.
They're scared of the culture changing, and I can understand that. But I think that all these other things, as far as welfare or all these other things, are kind of excuses for the real issue.
Well, and I think if you're ever going to use the government as a tool to try and stop cultural change, that you've got a whole host of issues that are going to come with that. I think we've seen that time and time again. Especially as a libertarian, I'm scared to see the government used as a tool for anyone to accomplish whatever personal goal it is that they have, but especially to try and stop cultural change out of fear or whatever.
Catherine?
I think the thing that concerns me as a small business owner and employer and workman's compensation insurance purchaser is that we spend a lot of energy criticizing the undocumented workers and very little time criticizing the employers who employ them, because we can't be negative to business. Lord forgive us if we do that. I don't buy this business that those are jobs that Americans won't do. Those are jobs that Americans won't do for $4 an hour or for $5 an hour. And why should we ask people to do menial labor? What the federal government is trying to do is bring in slave labor. We're saying, well, you come in for 6 years and work.
I have to, you know, I understand what you're saying, but in any legislation, I think there has to be compromise. And this is the compromise they came up with. you know, if certain people want all of the illegal immigrants in the country to have a path to citizenship or legal status or whatever, and other people want to ship 12 million people back to Mexico, neither position is doable, okay? So this is a compromise that they've come up with. And I think, you know, if that's the best we can do at this time, I think it's the best we can do. And I would support such legislation. To call them servants or slaves or whatever, I think sort of defeats the intent of the bill.
We can get into a minimum wage discussion if you want. I think this is...
It kind of leads into it.
It certainly does. I don't know if that's the crux of the issue with the voters right now in Georgia. Because I think that the voters in Georgia have a certain idea about the crises that they think illegal immigration poses. And I don't know if necessarily... labor conditions and the pay rate are on the forefront.
One of the things is that they think that people are not paying taxes, and so they're getting use of public services without paying into them. But that is not the case.
Not true.
Many of the undocumented workers are paying taxes, and they'll never collect them because they're not reporting them.
Yeah, and I saw a great statistic that's the amount of Social Security taxes that are being paid by undocumented workers, and how the system would be in even worse shape right now if we didn't have illegal immigrants paying.
Hallelujah! Put it in the lockbox.
No one's ever answered the question to me satisfactorily. If we told all the 12 million illegal immigrants to go back home, how would our economy absorb the loss of that many workers? Oh. Nobody has ever provided me an answer to that question.
That's one of the things that I say to people when they say, we got to get rid of all these illegal aliens. I say, well, okay, fine, let's do it. But are you going to pay $7 for your chicken sandwich?
Not to mention what it's going to cost to find them all.
I saw the number. I saw $315 billion.
It'd be disastrous for our economy.
It's ridiculous. It's hard to ever come up with an estimate for compliance on a government program. You see how much it costs us to comply with X regulation. You brought up the point about how, you know, it's slave labor because they're coming in for less money, and then you ask people how would they deal with, you know, your chicken sandwich being $7. But how would you deal with
it? I would be fine with that.
Yeah.
I'm perfectly happy paying higher taxes. Paying higher, more money for my chicken sandwich. You will never hear me complain about the taxes in this country.
We've talked a lot about the economics of immigration, but I mean, it's really what is the humane thing to do? We can talk about they want to secure the borders. Fine, make the borders tough, make it tougher to get from Mexico to here. I think we can all pretty much agree with that. Mm-hmm. But the people who are already here, what do we do with them? What is the humane solution? And the humane solution has to be to allow them to become citizens in some way. When most of our ancestors came to the United States, we didn't have immigration law. They came and showed up on our shores and said, let us in. Today, they would be illegal immigrants.
Yeah. I think there's also a historical perspective that I thought I'd chime in with. Back in those days, there was a lot of tension that occurred between blacks and Irish, you know, Chicago, New York, and so on and so forth, because employers would hire the blacks, and when the blacks threatened a strike because they weren't getting paid enough, the employers threatened the blacks by saying, we're going to hire the Irish. And the Irish at that time were lower in class. So it fueled a huge, I guess you could call it a class warfare type of situation, which probably is not quite the same as what's happening today. But it really goes to show that what happened in the subsequent years, I think, can be a lesson for us today to say we don't necessarily need some kind of a revolution, you know, where suddenly we're going to ship all of the illegals out and absorb the shock to the economy. Instead, with the existing immigration laws that we have, and seeing how difficult it is for anyone to become a citizen, especially for the right reasons, there's a lot of attention that I think should be paid to that side of the equation. You want to come here to work, you want to come here to study in school, we should welcome you. We should, you know, and the existing laws make it very difficult to do that.
All right. Well, I think that we've kind of beaten an already dead horse to a second death. This is an interesting time because state primaries are coming up. We've got the Democratic primary. One thing that I'm kind of wondering is, how is the Cynthia McKinney cop beating story going to affect...
I don't think I heard about that.
How is it going to to affect either, you know, the Georgia Democratic primary and the actual statewide elections, you know, in November.
Well, you know, Mark Taylor has been endorsed by Cynthia McKinney.
Yes, and I'm wondering how that's going to affect, because I don't think that this has necessarily hurt her all that much in DeKalb. My impression is she's going to breeze through. And so Mark Taylor might make it, but then, I mean, he's got Cynthia McKinney backing him in the statewide election. I don't think that that's a very good sign for him.
Well, I think it depends on whether he's counting on the elusive swing voter, or if he's going to, you know, pound the pavement and get voters who have not been voting. If he's going to try to inspire...
Everyone tries to do that.
It never seems to work, does it?
No, it doesn't seem to work, but I think that is... if he's worried about Cynthia McKinney, that would be a strategy that he could use that would might help him, because I think you're right in being concerned about the swing voter.
The only thing
voting
I could,
for someone who's endorsed by Cynthia McKinney.
I could see maybe like that might change is if like Republicans in the 4th district decided to go back into the Democratic primary.
That's not going to happen this year because you've got such
a lot of races in the Republican Party.
It was a totally different picture in 2002
It's not like you can just pull a Republican ballot for one race. You've got to pull for the whole thing. And so then they're going to have to give up voting for Cagle or...
A lot has been made about the Republican crossover vote in the 2002 election, you know, making Majette the winner. Majette would have won anyway. If all of 14,000 people that voted in the 2004 Republican primary had not voted for, had crossed over and voted for Majette, Majette would have still won. So Majette would have won anyway. Even if all the Republicans in DeKalb County had voted for her, which didn't happen because 5,000 people voted in the Republican primary that year.
Well, I'll tell you, I think that what happened after that is I think it got Cynthia McKinney to get her people out, because she gets her people out now. She works her people really well now. So I think she learned a lesson from that. At least that's my opinion.
Yeah, unfortunately.
What sort of impact does it have outside of the 4th District, though? I mean, does she have any pull on people, on voters outside of the 4th District?
What I keep hearing is that the 4th District is the majority of the Democratic primary. Like, people who vote in the Democratic primary, like a large chunk of them are in the 4th District. That's what, I mean...
I find it hard to believe.
That's true. I'm sure that, I mean, there's a few precincts in DeKalb County that had among the highest voting percentages for the Democrats in the nation. Mm-hmm. In 2004. But there's a lot of Democrats in Fulton, too. I mean, there's John Lewis's district, which is very, very Democratic. Yeah. That's where I live. I mean, I live in a district that has very high voting, and, you know, one person in my zip code gave to George Bush in 2004. So there's Democratic precincts, you know, throughout Fulton and DeKalb. But that's where, are where they are. And then in Savannah.
And there are Democrats outside of DeKalb and Fulton County. I mean, you know.
There are.
Yeah.
Georgia's purple, really. Yeah. When you start looking at it more
carefully.
Yeah, we're
pretty well bruised.
Well, what about some other statewide races?
I think the Secretary of State's race is going to be interesting on the Democratic side. It's so big. There's so many.
There's so many, and the fact that an unknown candidate before he ran for Secretary of State has raised so much money, and I'm talking about
Sham
Reddy.
Well, he's not really unknown. He was one of the founding board members of the Red Clay Democrats, and he's been very involved in Democratic politics.
He's just been an insider the whole time.
Yeah, he just has never run for office. But
I heard him on the Airloaf radio show. Which, I mean, he was really polished, and he was really good at kind of presenting his views and answering the people who were calling in and talking to him. So,
what are the views of the Secretary of State?
Well, you know, they talk about the thing that concerns me is I think that because of all the issues around the voting machines in Georgia, that we're focusing a lot on that, which is very, very important, and maybe sometime we can do a whole show about election reform. But the Secretary of State's job is very complicated. There's a lot of other things that they're responsible for.
Corporate records,
the Georgia archives, and certification, all the professional certification.
They have to decide what kind of religions our science teachers can teach. And what kind of stickers we need on our books. As well.
I'm glad to see, because I know Sham and Scott Holcomb, who's another candidate, and I've seen most of them. And
Carol Jack, is she
running? She's not running. She dropped out because she's running for her old Senate seat again.
There's some others.
Yeah. Oh, there's Daryl Hicks, Angela Moore. But of the ones that I've seen, I've been impressed by Scott Holcomb and Sham Reddy's understanding of those other things that are a big responsibility.
Not to give more props to Kathy Cox, but she put the whole Secretary of State's system online. And as a lawyer, you know, it's you used to have to go down to the Secretary of State's office to figure out the corporate filings on sort of. You can just go on the website now and type in a name, and all the corporate filings come through. So, you know, we don't need anybody like Bill Stevens, who can't even get his own campaign records together, running that office. It would be a disaster for business in Georgia.
Yeah, I agree. I think the whole technology is a really important component of the Secretary of State's office, including the elections. And I think Kathy Cox has done a good job in that regard on many points. Mm-hmm. Not on all, but on many points.
Anyone have any particular feelings on the Cagle-Reed race for lieutenant governor?
I know I've spoken out about people who want to vote in the Republican primary to stop Ralph Reed, and I think it's preposterous. Let them make their own mistakes. If you're a Democrat, there are a lot of important races, including the governor's race, that you know, this is really, in my opinion, this is the last chance for Democrats for another 10 years to try to regain some authority in the state. And if you just sort of toss it out to try to do something with Ralph Reed, it makes no sense. But I think that Cagle might win.
Well, you know, the thing that bothers me is this, like, feeling, and I think that the Republicans may do this on purpose, is to make Ralph Reed look so bad so that we all think that Casey Cagle is so good, and he's just as bad.
He might be more conservative than Reed. He's just not as flamboyant.
He's a real believer. Yeah. You know, Reed is all, you know, spit and polish, and Cagle's, he's a real believer. He's terrible on the environment. Oh, my gosh. My friends who are involved, like, with the Upper Chattahoochee Riverkeeper, he's horrible.
And we got to remember that, you know, Mark Taylor has no power now because the Senate is Republican. If there's a Republican lieutenant governor in charge of a Republican Senate, that's a very powerful position, particularly when Eric Johnson is talking about retiring.
Yeah, and also, you know, just as far as, like, who a Democrat maybe would rather face, I think there would be a lot more to target against Reed versus Cagle, just because he's such a more well-known figure.
Oh, I think that if it's Reed, we'll get tons of national attention, and whoever is, yeah, whoever is the Democrat will be able to raise the money.
On the other hand, I understand the idea, okay, we have a chance now to shut Ralph Reed down. If we defeat him here, he'll never be governor, he'll never be president, he'll never ruin all of our lives. I understand that thought, and if we've got to deal with Casey Cagle for 4 years as a trade-off, you know, I can understand that line of thinking too.
And then on the other side, they're right now thinking, what do you say to a swing voter to get him to vote for Ralph Reed? And, I mean, that's the question, right? And I don't have an answer.
I'm not sold on the idea, though, that any of our Democratic candidates in the lieutenant governor's race can beat Ralph Reed. And that scares me.
You know, I mean, that Georgia politics would just become the laughing stock of the nation, which it wouldn't be the first time.
Well, I don't know that Georgia politics is a shining star right now. So. Yeah. Anyone have anything else they want to talk about with statewide races?
Hey, otherwise, so you said the question says what races should we be watching that we probably aren't. I couldn't tell if this was a NASCAR question or a xenophobia question.
Oh.
That's all. Well, I think the school superintendent.
Oh yeah,
could
yeah.
be interesting.
Well, given that Kathy Cox with a K has not raised any money, has like $40,000 in the bank, and Denise Majette, you know, everything everybody said about Denise Majette, she you know, has run a statewide race, got 40% of the vote, has name recognition. She could give Kathy Cox a real challenge. I just wonder how many voters will vote for Kathy Cox just because of her name, or vote against her just because of her name.
Yeah, but, you know, maybe more people would, if Kathy Cox, like, either Kathy Cox ran against Denise Majette, maybe there are a lot of people who would vote for Denise.
It would really be confusing if Kathy Cox ran against Kathy Cox.
Well, I think it'll be interesting to see how it plays out just for the ticket, you know.
All right.
Like, will Denise Majette get votes just because people are voting straight ticket, or the other way around, you know. But It sure would be nice to have that Kathy Cox out of there, because she, talk about a laughing stock. My friends all over the country, they're like, who's this? You're trying to get rid of evolution? The word evolution? And you're like, yeah.
It is interesting, though. other than Sonny Perdue, every Democrat won in 2002 as a statewide race. You know, the lieutenant governor, agriculture commissioner, secretary of state, all those, except school superintendent Kathy Cox. You have to wonder.
I think her name is the only thing going for her, really.
I totally think that there's people who voted for her because they think she's Kathy with a C. Oh, I'm sure.
They just know I'm voting for
and
Kathy Cox.
People like Kathy Cox. You know, she's very dynamic and she has appeal. She has appeal on both
I wish
sides.
They put pictures up in the ballot. See that mugshot of Kathy Cox with the K.
Oh, then we get into people voting because of which candidate looks the best. And I'm not sure we should ever.
Yeah, and then you get all those.
Save that for the presidential.
Get those glamour shots, photos that some of these candidates have in urine.
I think all of us are from the metro Atlanta area, and there's always a lot of interesting, kind of shady things that are happening in Atlanta. And one of the interesting things, and maybe shady, I'm not sure, is the project to kind of get the beltway going. And
Beltline.
To get the beltline going, which would be basically a train that just goes through the inner city of metro Atlanta, right?
That's how it started out. It was, as many of us know, it was a master's degree project from a gentleman by the name of Ryan Gravel.
It was Georgia Tech, right?
Yeah, from Georgia Tech. This little project was discovered by Kathy Woolard and then and championed by Kathy, and it just kind of took on a life of its own. And the vision became beyond transit and into trails and parks, increasing green space in Atlanta. Probably the most difficult hurdle that it had to clear so far, although it should have been the easiest decision, was whether or not to pass the funding for this project. And it had to pass through three different councils, the Atlanta City Council, Fulton County or Commission, and the Atlanta School Board, because all three of those bodies would have to appropriate some future earnings from property taxes toward the Beltline project. And from there, you know, how that money would be spent would be decided by, I guess, some kind of a commission or another with everyone's approval, and it just gets even more complicated from there.
But they've all passed, right?
So they all passed, yep.
When was this?
Last year.
Last year. Yeah, this was over the course of 2005. So now, of course, the decision has to be made of how to spend all this money. How much money comes in will all depend on how much the property values of that area rises over time, because that's the only bit of those property taxes that can be collected toward the Beltline, if that made any sense.
I think it does, and I think that really raises the biggest issue so far is land use associated with around the Beltline. Is everybody wants this Beltline, but they don't want to have the sort of density that's required in order to raise the taxes enough to support the transportation.
Sure, and when we think of density, it's pretty easy to think of Singapore or slums, or, you know, the sort of density that once existed in urban America that is not really the sort of planned density that we're looking at for the future with the new urbanist movement. And we could look at Atlantic Station. That's an example of a fairly high level of density that doesn't really feel so dense and crowded.
I think part of it too is if you look at some of the neighborhoods that this goes through, they're kind of wealthy neighborhoods already. So these people,
at least on the northeast.
Yeah, on the part that a lot of the parts that I've heard some of the complaining about and some of the
Midtown, Beltline.
Some of that sentiment is all come from what I perceive as relatively wealthy areas of Atlanta.
Well, there's a lot of challenges in the poorer sections too, because there's concern about property values increasing in the neighborhoods adjoining the TAD, that's the tax allocation district, are concerned about their property values going up and then not being able to afford to live there when they've sacrificed for the next few years the building and the construction and the this and the that. Kathy Wooler told me that she feels like the most resistance is coming from those neighborhoods.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
And those are the areas that, my perspective, have the most to gain from the economic development that will go on when the Beltline goes through there. So it's really strange.
Well, there's a legitimate property tax issue.
Yeah. Well, there are a couple of issues when you say areas that will gain, that will come out of this project better than where they were before. There's also the people within those areas. What will happen to the people? And that's a subject of great concern. I haven't seen the numbers yet as to how many residents in this area rent versus how many own. Rents will, of course, go up. There's very little question to that, as well as the property taxes.
honestly, density is going to happen no matter what we do in Atlanta, but you kind of want to keep everything going according to a plan. Because one of the problems I have with the city, development's happened all over the place. No one's really controlled it or kind of guided it at all.
Yeah.
And,
except developers.
Exactly.
It's such a high degree of uncertainty, and this is what makes it scary for a lot of people. The uncertainty here is that whole planning process hasn't been quite laid out yet. That's still being negotiated.
I've been given the signal that we need to wrap it up. Any final thoughts you guys have?
Before this podcast, we also watched another group of folks record their own podcast for this same Georgia Podcast Network. And if you haven't listened to them, I would highly encourage it. They had a wonderful things to say about theater and theater in Atlanta. They were called the North Fulton Drama Club. And you can check them out at northfultondramaclub.org.
July 18th or whatever, 19th, can't come too soon, that's all I have to say.
If you've made it to this point, then I bet you know when Election Day is. Or have the ability to look it up on the computer.
It's a Tuesday.
I hope we do this again. I think it's been good.
Great. Well, I don't have any more awkward NASCAR jokes to come. I do want to take the time to thank Rusty and Amber for hosting this whole event.
Yes, thank you.
It's worked out very well from my perspective. You got a very nice setup here, and I hope we can do it again sometime.
And I just want to thank everyone who took the time to listen to this, and I want to thank all the members of the panel. You've been great. And also thank Rusty and Amber for giving us this opportunity. This is a Georgia Politics podcast, and I'm Joseph G. Thanks a lot. Goodbye.